vaccination sequence planned for your area. And book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine.
CKUT Radio, Community Radio, CKUT.ca, CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
Did you get vaccinated?
Not yet, but I will soon.
And which one are you getting?
I'm getting the dance vaccine.
The dance vaccine? Great idea.
Yeah, rehearsing with the girls is what I miss the most.
Well, it's going to be the soccer vaccine for me. I can't wait to see the gang again.
Each vaccination brings us closer to these moments. Follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome to Dragon Root Radio, Feminist Waves brought to you by CKUT and the Center for Gender Advocacy.
The Dragon Root Media Collective aims to bring you feminist content that challenges interlocking systems of oppression and makes space for voices systemically silenced. Dragon Root understands media as being inherently political and emphasizes media skill sharing as a form of resistance.
We meet every other Wednesday at 6 p.m. at the Center for Gender Advocacy and welcome anyone interested in learning or producing feminist media to join. No skills required.
Baby. Welcome to Dragon Root Radio. We're going to kick off today's show with an interview with one of the members of SPHR McGill, that's Students in Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights, McGill. SPHR is a non-hierarchical student organization that advocates to uphold the rights of the Palestinian people in the face of human rights violations and all forms of racism, discrimination, misinformation, and misrepresentation. Here is an interview about their upcoming event, Safe Space and Conversation.
Thank you for having me. So I'm a McGill student and a Palestinian activist and organizer. I work with McGill SPHR and also with organizations and coalitions outside of McGill. McGill SPHR is McGill Students in Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights. It's a non-hierarchical student organization. We advocate to uphold the rights of the Palestinian people in the face of human rights violations, which includes all forms of racism, discrimination, misinformation, misrepresentation, and subjugation by the Israeli state. We're basically just a group of students who are committed to the liberation of Palestinian people from the genocidal settler colonial state that is the state of Israel.
Mm-hmm. Now, SPHR has been holding an event series called Safe Space and Conversation. So can you tell us a bit about this event and why it's important to hold this space on campus, although online?
Yeah. So this event has been held in collaboration with the Arab Student Network and also the Syrian Students Association. It's an event where basically Palestinian students and our allies can feel comfortable sharing their anxieties or feelings about the current uprisings and the state and safety of the Palestinian people on the ground. So many of us have been involved in organizing rallies and campaigns on and off campus, and this is like an especially stressful time. So we often just forget to take a moment and breathe and or talk about how we're doing, especially for those of us who are Palestinian. This kind of work is just extremely emotionally exhausting and draining because we're seeing our own people being violently dispossessed and subjugated by the occupation state and dehumanized. And we're constantly put in a position where we have to be educators, or we have to like maneuver discourse around whether we qualify for human rights. So it's just extremely exhausting, and it's not a job that we kind of can take a break from. So having a space like this has been extremely comforting for me and other students, I'm sure, especially when our administration has done like nothing. They've been nothing short of dismissive at best and just hostile at worst.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I do want to ask some questions a little later on about how McGill has responded, but just going to the event, what have been some of, I know you can't get into detail, it's a private space, but can you tell us about some of the broad takeaways from the event in terms of the impact the crisis in Gaza has had on students at McGill?
Yeah, of course. First of all, I want to talk about the importance of language, because when we're using the word crisis to describe an ongoing siege and blockade on Gaza, we're not contextualizing it within the context of within settler colonialism. Gaza or Gaza has been besieged for several years. It's an overcrowded open air prison, and 13-year-old children there who haven't already been killed by the occupation have survived about 4 assaults from the Israeli state. And it's also important to remember that the struggle for liberation isn't just about Gaza. All of Palestine is occupied. the residents of Sheikh Jarrah and Sinwan in Jerusalem are under constant threat of being dispossessed. Literally today, Muna and Muhammad al-Kurd, who are the twins who've been like kind of the face, the new faces of the struggle of Palestinian youth for liberation, were detained by the Israeli occupation forces and were charged with nationalism, quote unquote nationalism, and disruption of peace. 30 minutes ago, Muna was released, so that's good news, but Muhammad is still detained. And a week ago, 16-year-old Jenna Kiswani was shot in the spine in her own home while she was making a cup of coffee for her father. And that's not just about Jerusalem or the West Bank or Gaza. Even Palestinian citizens of the Israeli state in the 1948 occupied territories who have the Israeli citizenship were hunted down and arrested by occupation forces a couple of weeks ago when the Operation Law and Order was launched. And before that, there were lynch mobs in these territories, and civilian Israeli settlers were personally hunting down and terrorizing Palestinians, and it was live streamed on TV. So I can go on and on and on. It's something that's been going on for 73 years. It's nonstop. It's nonstop. Even my very own grandparents were exiled, refused the right to return. So the impact is very deep-rooted, and it's ongoing. It's emotionally draining, and it's exhausting. It's frustrating. Sometimes it's debilitating. I've some students mentioned not being able to study, asking for their exams to be deferred, not being able to go to be present in their summer courses that they registered for. So yeah, the impact is just ongoing, deep-rooted, and never-ending.
So you mentioned some students have asked for deferred exams or and stuff like that. Has any of that been honored by the school, or what, has there been any meaningful action by the university to support Palestinian students in campus, on campus?
I haven't heard about any deferral requests being accepted yet. I know that McGill takes a really long time to do everything, so we're just going to have to wait and see. But as far as the way the university has been acting in the recent weeks and also literally forever, there hasn't been any kind of meaningful action to support Palestinian students on campus, let alone any kind of acknowledgement of our fears of being doxxed, surveilled, or harassed on campus. There's actually been an active dismissal of our efforts to get our administration to just understand what we go through. And our provost Manfredi's MRO a few weeks ago, where he deliberately refuses to even mention the words Sheikh Jarrah, Gaza, or West Bank, and refers to quote unquote violence in the Middle East, is solid proof that this administration is doing everything it can to ignore us and our demands. And where we want an apology for this, first of all, for this racist MRO, and second of all, we want an apology for their response to our open letter and petition to our chancellor and vice principal, Suzanne Fartier, before we even submitted the open letter. We want serious consideration of our demands, and we want them to acknowledge our fears of being on this campus.
Great. So you outlined some of the actions that SPHR would like to see. If students want to get involved, support this effort, what actions would you suggest or recommend?
The easiest thing that people can do, and also the main call to action from the ground, is literally sharing what's going on social media. Like I mentioned before, Muna and Muhammad al-Kurd were just detained. They have more than, I think, 2 million followers. And the occupation state is just scared of what they're sharing. And they're scared of people seeing what they're sharing, because they're sharing the truth of what's going on the ground. It's unfiltered, unedited, and it's just people literally taking videos with their iPhones and posting it on Instagram. So just literally share what you're seeing on Instagram, promote and platform Palestinian activists who've been speaking about this for years, and respect their efforts and what they put themselves through to educate everyone about what's going on. And for being active on campus, what students can do is just to email our administration with their concerns about the way Palestinian students are being treated, and to ask our administration to reconsider their actions and to tell them that what they're doing is not just like flying under the radar and it's not going to be forgotten. McGill University used to invest, fund, and just openly condone the South African apartheid until students held them accountable and forced them to divest from the apartheid and condemn it. So we can do this. There's been precedent. There is precedent, and we just need to keep trying, and we need to be extremely vocal about our demands.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if people want to attend the Safe Space and Conversation or any other SPHR events, where can they go?
Yeah, so our Facebook page is called Students in Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights McGill. You can also follow the Arab Student Network of McGill for the Zoom links and stuff. Our Instagram is SPHRMcGill. You can also sign up for our listserv through Facebook. And if you have any questions about being involved, you can DM us directly on these platforms and we'll respond as soon as we can.
Perfect. Well, thanks so much for chatting with me today, especially about this topic. I know it's really hard and a lot of labor to discuss, so I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for your questions.
Of course. Was there anything in the interview that we didn't get to that you kind of wanted more space for, or how are you feeling?
Personally, I'm feeling tired, but I'm glad that people are talking about this, and I'm glad that people are asking questions, and I want to emphasize the importance of asking questions when you feel like you don't know something. Mm-hmm. More often than not, Palestinians are happy to answer these questions because we talk about it either way, mm-hmm. whether you're asking these questions or not. So don't be ashamed to ask about what's going on the ground, and do the work, try to learn. I mean, that's the least everyone can do at this point.
Absolutely.
You're listening to Dragon Root Radio on CQT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Next up, we have the chance to speak with the founding editor of Cahul Journal about their recent issue on queer feminisms. Here is that interview.
First, thanks for having me. So my name is Riwa Sayer. I'm a queer feminist archivist, editor, and writer. I'm from Lebanon. I've lived in Lebanon my whole life, except now I have now moved to Paris, where I've been based for the past 6 months. And I'm currently doing my master's in gender studies at Paris 8, Université Vincennes-Saint-Denis. And I'm the editor, the founding editor of PEARL, a journal for body and gender research, and the co-founder of Intersectional Knowledge Publishers. And Intersectional Knowledge Publishers is the platform under which Cahul operates. So concerning Cahul, amazingly, we're already in our seventh year. and we have been producing knowledge for all of that time. And the idea behind Cahul was really to center and bring to the front knowledges that are not just produced, but that also exist among communities, the queer communities and feminist communities in the South, and particularly in West Asia and North Africa as the regions that we look towards. And we have been based in Beirut as a team for a very long time, except for the past 6 months, where we have moved, we have migrated to a transnational model, because we have literally like migrated in different places, where some of us are still based in Beirut, others in different places. I'm in Paris, someone else is in Istanbul. The idea behind this kind of knowledge that we bring to the front is to really rethink our imaginaries and be able to find a locality where we can make them concrete in a way, and put them out into the world. And I think we're going to talk about this a bit more later. In terms of what we do in general, so this is particularly Cahul as a publication. But what we do in general, so we focus on three main axes. The way I see those axes is that they do not exist in, you know, like two-dimensional planes, but they're kind of circling each other. One of them is publication, so publication as a medium, as a means, but also publication as what you put up there. So it's both. So what the structure of publication, the means of publication, but also what is it that is being published. The second one is translation. Translation from a technical perspective, as in we translate knowledge, but also from a conceptual perspective, meaning what are the mechanisms that would inform such a process in the first place, and how is it that we can queer them and reclaim them and make them ours in a way. And then the third one is communities, I would say, because of how we perceive those axes to be revolving around something that is not just local, but that is also alternative and that has been sidelined, which is where we really find our histories since we started working and right now as well. So this is a short introduction, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was looking at the website, and one of the things it mentions is that the journal intends to, the quote is, provide non-exoticizing, non-minority platform to promote independent knowledge. So can you speak a bit to what this means as an academic journal and why it's important to center?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that when we started, when Kohl started in 2014, we were really invested in the idea of speaking back to, so positioning ourselves as a counter discourse to. And I think this was coming from this history of really being written, like our bodies, our narratives being written into other people's stories, publications, etc. And in a way, so we were written out of our own stories. And by this, there was a clear like dynamic or power dynamic that existed between journalists, researchers, etc., that would come from other localities with more access, with more resources, and be able to perceive us as subjects of research. And so I think the first years were really oriented towards this idea of speaking back to that, of offering an alternative to that, of resisting this kind of being written out of our own stories. But I think it's changed. I mean, we still believe that those power dynamics exist, like it's not about denying them. But I think what we're trying to do right now has shifted from this position of having to answer to someone or to a power, like a bigger power all the time, to really going back to what is the work that we actually want to do? How is it that we want to organize? And how does this actually translate, whether in the publication means and content, or within the communities that we work with? And I think that what we've lived in Lebanon for the past 2 years has really consolidated the importance of that vision, in the sense that we do not want to or have to exist in relation to systems of power all the time and produce ourselves as such, but be able to also think of what is it that is important to us without existing in a vacuum, obviously, but how is it that we want to lead our struggle without being put in a position of response over and over again? And so this is to say that initially, yes, it's the idea is about, you know, non-exoticizing, non-minority, but those terminologies in a way are terminologies that respond to a discourse that would make us minority and make us or exoticize us in a way. So right now, what we are trying to do is shift that towards defining ourselves as a queer radical publication from the South, first queer in its politics, publication in, as I said, the means and the content, and then the South as a locality that is not geographical, but that is very geopolitical in a way. And another thing I'd like to mention about translation is the multilingual aspect of Kohl, because this is also, I mean, we are always called to produce knowledge in specific languages. And the idea that, and the notion that we can bring Arabic, for example, to the forefront of this struggle is also a way to break this dynamic of, you know, like systems holding the ability to produce knowledge and other systems that are more alternative, more minority, having to all the time respond to how they are being represented in a way.
Mm-hmm. And this is actually on a similar line to that, but as an academic and a feminist journal, can you speak to the importance of accessibility and access to the knowledge?
Well, I think like we can think about what access and accessibility mean first. So I think on the surface, I would like maybe talk a bit more about the open source aspect of doing such work, which was important for us because we felt that a lot of the conversations, and specifically theoretical conversations, are always somehow they're not freely available. And so one must either be part of an institution to have access to them, or be able to literally pay subscription fees in order to be privy to the conversations that happen. Unfortunately, those conversations, a lot of the times, are conversations that include us in the narratives that they present, and therefore, by including us in those specific forms of circulation, we are excluded because we cannot access them in the first place. So it's kind of this, it's kind of a weird, I don't know how to call it, but you know, it's being stuck into this loop in a way where we are called into as subjects of research, of interest, etc., but then we cannot have access to how is it that we are being represented. And this is a broader issue as well with how research is constructed as a whole. And maybe, you know, in the event that we will be doing, I think that we will be addressing this quite a bit. And we can talk about this a bit later. So in terms of the open access part of it, we've had to decide whether to have all of our content free and available and join the efforts of open source publishing transnationally. So that was one option. Another option was to have like subscription fees that would allow us a semblance of sustainability. And we chose the first one, obviously. So clearly this means that economically the circulation and the funding that we have to rely on is not like we fully rely on a funding model that would not be the case had we had subscription fees. So this was a kind of a political decision that we had to make and that we are working with right now. So this is in terms of, you know, the surface level of what open access means and what accessibility mean to such a project. But in terms of the circulation as well, it's also about who has access to saying what, in a sense, and who has access to theory, because a lot of the times we position theory as this medium that, you know, we cannot have access to because it's intellectual, because it's elitist, etc. And I would say to that actually theory has been made so that we cannot have access to it. But theory is something that exists, it's something that we do. Theory is our praxis. It's what we do in our daily lives. It's what we do within our communities. It's what we do to organize. So we are theory embodied in a way. And I think this is what the conversation on access and accessibility denies us. Because then we are kind of, you know, isolated in those divisions of who is doing what and who can say what, and who has access to what platform, that makes it impossible for us to project ourselves, to think of ourselves as having access to theory in the first place. And I think especially queer theory. And I think this is really one of the main points that we are trying to challenge in the work that we do.
Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting point and way of approaching it I hadn't thought of before. I want to talk a little bit more about the journal itself and the current issue, or from what I understand that is the current issue, number 6.3 on queer feminism. Can you tell us a bit about how this theme for this issue was selected and why it was important to dig into this theme?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, the issue on queer feminisms was published in December of last year, so about 2 months ago. And yeah, it's our sixth volume, so it marked the sixth year. We're in our seventh year right now, and it was the third issue of the past year. I think initially it has to do with this, the how the idea of queer has been passed on in a way. And I'm talking about queer as a political position rather than queer as an identity. That's not where I'm looking at, basically. So I'm more interested in the political position and the theory. And I think a lot of times, because of what I was talking about earlier, like this binarization of where knowledge is centered and where it's peripheral, we are somehow told that queer is a genealogy that doesn't exist for people in the South. And I don't want to generalize. I'm talking specifically about West Asia and North Africa. And I think the idea of naming this issue queer is about saying that, no, actually, we do have a queer genealogy. And this is not how queer or theory is passed on. That's not the only way it can be passed on. So we're not just waiting as passive receptors for those theories to reach us, for them to make sense. Because we can find them in our histories, in our ways of organizing, again, which is, you know, what I was saying about theory in general. So I think why queer feminisms? I think it's because we did not want to speak in euphemisms anymore, and we wanted to call it the way we were envisioning it, which is a political positioning that is both and this at once queer and feminist. And accounting for the plurality of it, the plurality of what this could look like as a political position rather than an identity, we went for queer feminisms in plural. Now, the way we worked with this issue was very different because it started with a writing workshop that was also called Queer Feminisms. So we first called for a writing workshop. We received quite a lot of applications, and we selected 8 writing projects. And we then met in Beirut in November, end of November, beginning of December, 2019. And it was literally at the height of, you know, the revolution in Lebanon, or at least the revolution in its visible and mediatized component. And I think the way we worked around it was truly like it was a queer feminist moment, because we were discussing methodologies, we were discussing our bodies in space, our bodies in theory, while at the same time living this broader political moment in the streets, embracing us in a way, and that we could then have it meet us at the same time. Embody it, having it embody us. So it was this kind of exchange at a different level that we had not, I think neither of us had experienced that before. So it was really embodying and living queer theory for days together as a collective. And there was some kind of collectivity that was formed as a result. And so these projects are now published in the issue, but we then opened it as well to other submissions. And so it is the collection of those writing projects plus other submissions that we received through our traditional call for papers and submissions. Why was it important to feature? I think because of the moment that we are in, whether as Kohal in terms of the politics that we are trying to bring to the surface and out into the world, but as well the political moment that we have been living, whether in the geography of Lebanon or regionally or even transnationally from the South.
And can you tell us a bit about some of the submissions you received for this issue, and if there were any kind of sub-themes that particularly stood out to you or inspired you?
I'd like to stop a bit on methodology aspect of it, because for me, what is really what makes this issue different is that there is a consistent challenge of what research methodology can look like. I mean, and I'm saying consistent because we've had that in other issues, but we haven't had that consistently in a whole issue. And I think what this issue does is really to make us think, what makes a piece publishable? What makes a piece research? What makes it count as research? And I'm aware that a lot of these questionings would not even make it to to many journals, let's say, but we wanted specifically to kind of break this taboo in a way, this academic taboo of publication. And so I think I'd like to stop maybe at Sarona's piece on return, because at the very beginning, this project was very scholarly, let's say. And it wasn't just, you know, limited to this one person, but I remember that at the workshop, we kept talking about, this is all great. All of these pieces that we are reading are amazing, but where are you in this piece? And why is it that we have this compulsion to write ourselves out of the pieces that we are presenting to the world? And it's kind of a, I think it has to do with this disciplining of the academe that we find ourselves compelled to just erase what is important to us. So Suture Fragmentations, Sarona's piece, ended up being not just in its content, but even the format of it, really breaking what is it that constitutes publication, and academic publication in particular, because of, you know, sometimes she would end in the middle of a sentence, like a paragraph in the middle of a sentence, and she incorporated her own poetry with pictures that she had taken. And I think it just embodies the way that we have really seen and thought of methodologies, queer methodologies that we would be working with from different localities and different imaginaries.
Now, as you mentioned a little earlier, there is an upcoming event to discuss the issue. Can you tell us a bit about the speakers and what audiences can expect?
Okay, so basically another thing, I think what we've been trying to do is to really have more public events, which has been, we had started with this effort with a lot of conferences and workshops, and it's been halted a bit because of the pandemic, obviously. So we're trying to pick it up again with online events. And so we thought that in order to do justice to this issue that has taken so much work, so much labor, and so much imagination and projection from so many of us, we thought that we would like to launch it officially in an online event. And my co-editor and I, so Sabiha and I, were thinking of potential discussants for the issue. And the idea behind that is to have somebody in the field of queer theory be able to address the work that we have done, the issue, the authors, us as the team of Kohol, the editorial team, but also our region and our political aspirations. And so we basically asked Sara Ahmed, who said yes. And so she will be the one responding to and maybe contextualizing what it means to have such a production or such a publication in a moment like the one that we are living right now. And so I think what is to be expected is an address by myself and my co-editor Sabiha, And then a presentation by four of our authors. We've already talked about Saruna. There will be three others as well, namely Aya, Ahmed, and Noor. And then there will be space for Sara Ahmed to discuss the issue and the theoretical contribution that it does, it makes. And then finally, we'll end with a Q&A. So basically, we registration, we opened registration and we literally, like, we had no tickets left within a few minutes. It was really, I mean, I think this is the biggest event that we will be moderating and organizing so far. So what we're doing instead is we'll have the event live streamed on Facebook so that it reaches the people who actually wanted to attend, and in the spirit of open source publishing. So we would like it to be available to the public.
And for people who either attend the event or read the issue, what do you hope they take away?
I guess that it is possible to imagine different ways of doing theory, of doing in general. There are also different ways of being in terms of how is it that we organize, who do we respond to, under whose terms, and that imagining different means of production that do not rely on systems of power that we are trying to dismantle, means of production that are queer, that respond to our political imaginings are possible.
And if people want to learn more, if they want to attend the event, or send in their own submissions to the journal, where can they go?
Okay, so they can go to our Facebook page, Kohal Journal, K-O-H-L, and Journal, and we tweet at Kohal Journal, so K-O-H-L, Journal. And our website is koholjournal.press. We have a call papers open right now. It's about a revolutionary archive of 2020, and people can send us submissions, submit at koholjournal.press for this particular issue.
Thank you so much again.
That was our interview with Kohal Journal on their recent issue on queer feminisms.
You're a silent forest, you're a wild flower, you've been moving backwards into the wildfire, but you're a sharpened arrow, spearing hearts, stone cold, and you're a red-winged blackbird, perched up on the wind. The darkest of wars. He never gave you time or the space to soar. But you're a sharpened arrow that tried to spear a heart stone cold, and you're a red-winged blackbird perched up on the window. Fly, carried on your back.
Empty, alone, waiting. Everything that did. we've all learned from COVID-19 is that something small can spread quickly, like a ripple. If enough of us do our part by getting vaccinated, we can start a wave. A wave of Canadians helping each other return to the people and places we love. We can all help by getting vaccinated. Learn more at canada.ca/COVID-vaccine. A message from the Government of Canada.
All right, get ready for Wolf Eyes Live and in conversation with Leith Campbell. June 16th at noon. Get ready to hear the Wolves' new style. See the new performance approach. Learn about the splatter. And ask your question. June 16th at noon. Wolf Eyes will see and hear you there. Make sure to tune in June 16th at noon. Or ccut.ca or SUNY Pale Pop.